night. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show today, so I'm going to just intro it really quick. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman on the event that they're presenting coming up very shortly, in about 2 weeks, I guess, Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? Two films and two panels about 2 weeks from now. All right, so that's, and Dave and Perry will be in to talk with us today about this anti-fascist film festival that they're holding, all right? And before that, we'll be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian from his film, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America, a better world is possible. And we'll talk more about that as we get to it. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing back to the show Stanley Cohen. Stanley's a radical lawyer and human rights activist. And we're going to be talking with him about When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality, a piece that he just recently wrote. And basically, I'm just going to jump right into this because I want to get as much time to talk with him as possible. Stanley, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for inviting me again. Always a pleasure to share some time with you and your audience.
Good, good. Well, we enjoy sharing time with you too, so let's jump into it. The title of your piece, and I should tell people, if they want to read the whole piece, it's in the April 13th edition of Counterpunch, and it's titled When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality. But you introduce your piece by referring to the comments of the Chief Counsel for the United States, which opened up the Nuremberg trials and the prosecution of Nazi war criminals. Let's talk about that. How come?
Well, look, you know, history is nothing else. If we're not disciplined and principled and consistent, it guarantees to repeat itself, and all too often it's the most ugliest repetition imaginable. I mean, we went to great pains at the end of World War II to hold the Nuremberg tribunals, multiple trials of Nazi war criminals, which included political leaders and military leaders and judicial leaders and ranking soldiers and politicians, to hold a tribunal for basically the first time in certainly recent history, if not ever, in which we preached from on high about the need of holding accountable officials that embrace, that enforce, that oversee crimes against humanity, war crimes, in particular crimes that target civilians on the basis of their race, their religion, their politics, their belief, their gender, their sexual orientation. And multiple Nazi war criminals were held to account for pretty much identical war crimes that today can be laid at the feet of Israel and have for 70 years. So I started with Nuremberg because, you know, obviously a prime group, if not the prime group, that was subjected to war crimes and crimes against humanity on the basis of race, religion, politics, et cetera, during that time were Jews. And here we are 70 years later, 73 years later, that, you know, the people that were victimized, and it wasn't just the Jews in the Holocaust, because, you know, there were millions of gypsies and communists and anarchists and Christians and artists and gay women and men and activists were also slaughtered by the regime. But as a group, you know, the Holocaust rings ever present in the mind of so many people today, and the paradox that we began with the Nuremberg Tribunal 73 years ago, and now we find ourselves, the victims, becoming the victimizers and engaging in the identical conduct, which resulted in many dozens of Nazis being hauled before an international tribunal and charged with offenses, some of whom ended up committing suicide. I believe some who were actually executed. And to really twist it on its head, a good many of them ended up being released, including some that ended up going to Western countries to help them with their missile programs and other munition efforts. But the connection that I wanted to draw was Nuremberg, victims 73 years later, victimizers, and if you're going to apply international human rights law, the law of war, war crimes, and genocide, you've got to be consistent. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to be consistent, that means tribunals, and that means the leadership of the Israeli occupation force, that means the political, military, and even rabbinical leaders to some degree in Israel have to be held accountable as well today under well-settled law.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's step back for a minute because I want to get into that, but I also want to explore this a little bit too, because there's a way that this is happening, repeating itself now, and you get into that later in the article, but there's a way that this thing of what you say that what the Nazis did, you know, look, basically, well, what the Nazis did wasn't a secret, but the world chose to look away, and you called it a well-calculated historical rewrite that stripped the Jewish people their history, culture, and collective purpose and decency. And then you dive into how this history is repeating itself in relation to the state of Israel today. I think it's important for people to sort of grapple with that a little bit. So can we talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's you know, sure. The ovens, the boxcars, the assassinations, the slaughters, that's well documented. But it just doesn't happen overnight. And it's very much, as I call, the grand lie of Israel. And Israel does the same thing today. Everything is rewritten. Everything is a lie. Everything is an excuse. Everything is a pretext. You know, propaganda, Hasbara, far more effective and efficient today than it was even in the run-up to World War II, but it lays the groundwork for the kind of ongoing, unbroken violation of human rights and war crimes that we're seeing today. And that's what the Nazis did in the 30s, leading up to World War II, where they began to control the means of communication, where they began to close newspapers, where they began to close, you know, radio stations, where they began to ban meetings and discussions and newspapers, and they took over the party line. They controlled what it was that people were allowed to discuss, to view, the vision of the times, the grand lie, the grand rewrite. So people suddenly were cast based upon their religion, were cast based upon their ethnicity, were based upon their language in a certain light. And that's exactly what Israel has perfected, far better than the Nazis ever did 70 years ago. They've done since literally the Nakba began in 1948, and it continues on right now. So you have, in the last several weeks, the slaughter, and again, there were three young martyrs today in Gaza, the border, where, you know, Israel completely rewrites events that are unfolding in front of the world, where the narrative is always controlled, where Israel controls what large swaths of the public are able to see, what they can read, where there are boards of censorship that are controlling dissemination from newspapers that have the power to vet stories, where you have in the West, where you have Israel using organizations such as AIPAC and other, for example, anti-BDS movements and organizations to control the narrative, the grand rewrite, the historical lie, the excuse, which turns Israel today into the victims. They're the people under siege, and that's exactly what happened in the run-up to World War II, where the German people were under siege by foreign elements, by communists, by Jews, by anarchists. They controlled the narrative, and from there, the march to murder, the march to boxcars, the march to mass slaughter is a very straight line and easy.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stanley Cohen, radical lawyer and human rights activist, and we're talking about something that's coming off of an article he recently wrote and published in Counterpunch, and it's called When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality. And Stanley's an attorney, and he's represented hackers, Occupy activists, homeless, anti-war protesters, Muslim clerics, American Indian activists, and Anonymous in the PayPal 14 case. And he still keeps kicking butt as we're going along. So I really want to jump into this more because you were just talking about all this thing about this, and you mentioned in your piece that there's a selective reality and expedient deception in operation in relation to Israel. What is this, and what's been the consequences of this?
Well, it picks and chooses, and by the way, just for purposes of full disclosure, I just happened to represent Hamas for 20 years. So I've been very much involved on the ground. This is not some sort of abstract, you know, intellectual area of interest to me. Until Israel banned me and until Egypt has now banned me, I've been to Palestine, I don't know, 10, 15 times and represented Hamas, the leadership of Hamas, and other Palestinian organizations. So I've had the benefit of on the ground. So the selective reality is, you know, Israel will focus on a quote, lone wolf attack. Whether it's a little missile, and I mean firecrackers taped together that land in the desert coming out of Gaza, or whether it's a 17-year-old kid who can't take it anymore and attacks a soldier with the scissors, they'll take that and they'll exploit it. They'll manipulate it. They'll expand it. They'll twist it into some sort of, you know, massive policy of Palestinian resistance that's organized, that's designed to go after settlements as whole, and then they lay the ground for the excuse. And the next thing you know, there are bombing runs and attacks, and 10, 20, 30, 50, 100, 2,000, 2,500 civilians are killed as a result of this selective pick and choose of events. And once the quote response is unleashed, there's a rewrite of that. So everyone becomes a front for Hamas. Everyone becomes, you know, all of a sudden resistance groups become terrorist organizations. All of a sudden, kids who were bombed, people that are United Nations centers that are hit, UNRWA stations, shelters that are bombed with dozens on occasion, 100, 150 children, women, and the elderly killed. It's an unfortunate price of war because, quote, Hamas had mortars 50 yards away, and war can be painful. So it's that continuation of cherry-picking isolated events, blowing them up into a grand lie that is then manipulated and used by their apologists to unleash and justify war crimes. I mean, the essence of the Nuremberg Tribunal, and we're seeing it unfold every Friday now in particular, is you can't target civilian populations. You cannot single out civilians for any use of weapons. There are areas where incidental casualties and damage happen. I have another piece that's coming out in Al Jazeera in the next few days or next week that talks about in the 1850s and 1860s, I mean, there were one particular battle, there were 40,000 military losses and one civilian lost their life. We have gone from civilian casualties at one point being less than 5% of all those casualties in warfare to today where they're 95% of all the casualties in warfare. And most of that is because we now target civilians. And no one does that better or worse than Israel, where Gaza, 2 million civilians are regularly attacked, bombing runs, phosphorus, cluster bombs, poison sprayed on farms, the destructions of animals. So the selective use of history leads into, the selective use of events leads into the grand lie and the grand excuse. And what we in the West typically get is, oh, well, you know, things happen. For example, the slaughter that's taken place the last four Fridays, now 4 weeks, at this grand nonviolent civilian peaceful march on the barricades at Gaza, which has resulted now in 35 women and men, mostly young boys, assassinated, most of them shot in the head, in the back of their head or in their back, and some 5,000 wounded and casualties. They don't have weapons. They don't have guns. They don't have rockets. You have this group of snipers that are lined up over the hill that just take pot shots and just kill demonstrators. And, of course, Israel twists it and turns it into this mass attempted breakout from what, the world's largest concentration camp? So it's part of this continuum that fascist, the totalitarian regimes have used to manipulate and control the debate, the discussion, the narrative as an excuse to cover war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide. And no one has been more proficient at that for 70 years now than Israel.
Although I would, I'd posit somebody else that's actually pretty proficient at it too, and that's one of the questions I wanted to get into with you, is you rightfully talk about all the horrors that Israel has unleashed against the Palestinian people, but in thinking about it, I was also thinking, well, we would be well put to include the working agreement between Israel and the U.S. when it comes to the Palestinian people and the slaughter.
Oh, God, well, you know, listen, there's something called the Arms Export Control Act, which was a legislative enactment a number of years ago that there's a class of recipients of weapons. And it's interesting, someone just wrote a piece and talked about the failure of the United States to enforce humanitarian law in exchange for aid from the United States. Well, it's the Arms Export Control Act. It's an act that Sanders has refused. Actually, Senator Leahy's tried to enforce it. Sanders is opposed to it. Almost everyone in the Senate is opposed to it. The Arms Export Control Act was a bill that was passed a number of years ago that says, look, if we're going to provide either aid or money or actual weapons to countries every quarter, there has to be a certification based upon international law and based upon independent evaluation that they're not being used in violation of international law. And when it comes to Israel, there's two or three remarkable, unique guideposts of our relationship to Israel. Unlike almost every other country in the world where we provide weapons and money for weapons on a quarterly basis and charge interest, Israel gets a lump sum without interest once a year. Unlike all other recipients under the Arms Export Control Act that have to certify and are certified as compliance of international law every quarter, it's never happened with Israel. Attempts by Congress to force the executive, the president, to apply the Arms Export Control Act have been repeatedly battered down by courts under separation of powers argument. And so what Israel gets is this never-ending either money or never-ending weapons from the United States that are used in this. Bernie Sanders, the great enlightened savior, was the prime pusher in the trillion-dollar F-35 development project because he saw it as a good means to get working people on board in Vermont. Well, later on, it's discovered that two Israeli companies had a piece of the development project. What are F-35s used for? They're used in Israel to drop bombs on Gaza, to murder civilians. So there is this relationship. And it's easy to say, you know, $30 billion, $40 billion, $50 billion. It's abstract. You reach a point that doesn't really hit home. What hits home is when you see a 15-year-old today assassinated by an Israeli sniper just as easily with an American-provided weapon, either provided as a gun or the money for it, shot in the back of the head for what? Carrying a Palestinian flag and screaming, I want to go home? So you're right. You know, you come down to it. There's two subsidies going on here. Subsidy number one is providing weapons from the United States and providing money for weapons from the United States. But every bit as much of a subsidy, and it's part of my next piece that's coming out on Al Jazeera, is the fact that Israel, that the United States has executed, has used the veto power in the Security Council 38 times to protect Israel in the last 15 years. 38 times. They've used it twice in the last 2 weeks or the last 2 months. Once on the move to Jerusalem and now on the attacks going on in Gaza. So they're not only arming Israel, they're not only funding Israel, they're not only closing their eyes to Israel in Congress with the Arms Export Control Act. Whenever the world body gets together, whenever the Security Council says it's enough, when it comes to Israel, there's a veto. So it goes nowhere. Mm-hmm. So it's this combination of economic support, blind obedience, and veto power at the United Nations that has permitted Israel to unleash this war against humanity when it comes to Palestinians now going on 70 years. You know, it's interesting because keep in mind, you know, the United Nations was formed essentially in 48, as was Israel, not much long thereafter. And ever since, the United Nations has been a safeguard for Israel.
Mm-hmm. On that note, Stanley, we're going to have to promise to come back and talk with you again soon in the future, but we have to wrap it up now. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. Always a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you again.
Me too, Stanley. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Stanley Cohen, radical lawyer and human rights activist, and we've been talking about a piece he had in Counterpunch called When Zionism Rubs Up Against Reality. And as you heard, this is something that people really need to chew on, all right? And if you want to follow Stanley on Twitter, his Twitter handle is at Stanley Cohen Law. And by the way, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do that by using at MichaelSlate195. Once again, that's at MichaelSlate195. Lots of interesting stuff on that. We're going to take a quick, or actually what I want to say to people first is if you want to find out more about the case of Israel, if you want to find out more about Israel and what the hell's going on with there, you can find a really brilliant article called The Case of Israel, Bastion of Enlightenment or Enforcer of Imperialism. And you can find that at revcom.us. And when you get to revcom.us, just go to the, just click on the link to Revolution Newspaper. All right. So again, that's revcom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and The Case of Israel, Bastion of Enlightenment or Enforcer for Imperialism. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So stay tuned.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
There you go. We will not go down in the night without a fight. All right. All right. Given the topics we have today and even more so, everything that's going on in the world every day, every night, all the time. It's a hellified world out there now. And I really want people to actually jump into this film of a talk by Bob Avakian. And it's incredibly important, folks. It's really, you know, it's a film called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. And we're talking about a regime, U.S. imperialism, that could destroy civilization. And you think you know, but you don't know. But if you dig into this film, you're going to find out what you need to know, what you know, what you need to know, and you're going to be dealing with how do we actually take it on and stop this, all right? So I'm really, really pleased to be bringing to you another segment from the talk by Bob Avakian, from the film of a talk by Bob Avakian, and the segment is part of the questions and answers that followed the talk he gave last autumn. So let's just jump right into that now.
One of the ways that the Vietnam War was lost in Berkeley is that at that time we had independent news media that actually had voices from the left that were against the war regularly appearing in America's living rooms at a time when most people only had three channels to choose from. Now we have this huge multinational corporate news media that's fractured into 1,000 pieces. And even still, though it is fractured into 1,000 pieces, we can, people from You Refuse Fascism can barely get on air, and even then it's only on Fox News. Okay, Democracy Now! Won't even have people from Refuse Fascism on air to speak, much less MSNBC. So my question to you is, what sort of strategies do you think that we can come up with to get through this? Because one of the reasons that we don't see the sort of searching questions like you were asking about Pence, like, do you believe in evolution, are not asked is because the corporations that control our news media don't want them to be asked. They want that status quo to be maintained, and they will instruct their news professionals, half of whom don't even have journalism degrees, to maintain that status quo.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very important question. Well, I think there are different elements to the strategy. For one thing, you know, people who do have some prominence, you know, and it is hard for these media, these dominating media you're talking about, to ignore, you know, have to be struggled with and won, you know, to use their own influence to get on those channels and, I mean, those networks and put this out. For example, I'm thinking of, you know, back in the, I don't remember exactly when it was, but some time ago, but later than the 60s, I remember there was this scene on television where the L.A. sheriffs were brutally beating this immigrant. And Marlon Brando called up Larry King, who was then on CNN, and said, I want to come on and talk about this. And he did. You know, and then they attacked him, you know, for other things. But that's one example where you struggle with people who do have the kind of prominence that it's hard. In other words, look, a lot of this is you're dealing with contradictions, and we have to know how to understand and deal with them well. The contradiction is that the media is, in fact, an instrument of the ruling forces of this system, but it pretends to be a free press. It pretends to be the voice of the people, and so on, so on, you know, that, so on and so forth. So that's a contradiction you have to, you know, figure out how to turn to advantage. You know, how do you take advantage of the aspect where they're pretending to be, you know, a free press and not to be an official state media or whatever, you know, and that's what, you know, someone like Marlon Brando did. You know, he said, okay, look, you know, if you refuse to have me on here, then, you know, you're going to expose yourself as what you are. So they didn't want to not have Marlon Brando on because he had enough prominence that he would find other ways to let it be known what he wanted to say, and that they wouldn't let him say it in that medium. So that's one leg or one element I can see. Another is, you know, hey, let's you know, I mean, I know some of this is done by Refuse Fascism with the panels at Fox News, you know, but how about, you know, look, you know, someone like Amy Goodman does some good things, you know, but she also, you know, has a certain she has a certain limited framework that she wants things to stay within. Let's put it that way. Certain people she wants to promote, and she wants to promote those things that they're affiliated with, like, you know, ultimately the Democratic Party, to just get right down to it. But, you know, I saw the other day she had on Michael Moore, who's got his problems too. No, I mean, look, you know, we don't get perfect people, okay? You know, people are contradictory, you know, and they do good things one minute, and then the next minute they fall back into things that aren't helpful. But I did notice that he was on Amy Goodman, and he was saying some stuff that was wrong about why Trump got elected, you know, this whole idea about the white working class is suffering so badly economically. And yes, there are people in Appalachia and other places, but that's not essentially what elected Trump. You know, I mean, even though he comes from a different place than I do, I did think the article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in the Atlantic got a lot more to the truth of this, including pointing out that every category of white people that you could think of voted for Trump. Now, some of them, like people with college degrees, it was a very small majority. In others, it was a bigger majority. But every single category of white people voted for Trump. That's why he said Trump is the first white president. You know, he ran openly on the basis of white supremacy. So I don't agree with Michael Moore about that, and that's tied in with some deeper things that I don't agree with him about. But he was saying some important things. I guess he's doing this show on Broadway, The Terms of My Surrender, which is, you know, laying out from his point of view what would be required to get him to stop protesting, I guess, is the essence of it. I don't know if people have gone to that show, but, you know, he does involve the audience. And, you know, if they have, good. And if we should keep going back and get up and make statements. You know, I will say that on Amy Goodman, he was, in addition to some of the things that I thought were really wrong, he was saying some very important things, including he said, look, Trump is going to start a war. And when he starts a war, don't listen to the Democratic Party establishment that tells you you have to support this war. Get out and protest this war. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a good and important thing he said. And he said, look, you know, I don't think this is the exact analogy, but it's coming from a good place. Look, we're in the French Resistance now, referring to the French Resistance against the Nazi occupation of France in World War II. You know, we got to make sacrifices, you know, and obviously he's talking to a certain stratum of people. He said, you know, your kids got to be driven to soccer class. They can walk for a year. We got to get out. You know, you're having trouble in your marriage. You know, got to go to marriage counseling. Get along for another year. We got to get out of here. and you could see, you know, what he was getting at, you know, he was doing it with a certain amount of humor. But, you know, he was saying, look, this is what we got to do. And this is important. So people like that, we should be trying different. We should be going to the front of that show and leafleting with, you know, with the refuse fascism material. We should be going inside and getting up and in a friendly way, not in an antagonistic way, speaking up from the audience, you know, and calling on him to endorse and support and call on other people to be part of this. We should try to talk to him directly. And there are all different kinds of ways. You know, Amy Goodman, well, if she steadfastly refuses to put people from Refuse Fascism on there, some people from Refuse Fascism should go down to where she's broadcasting and make a stink, yeah. You know, and say, put us on there. You know, it's not acceptable. I mean, it's not acceptable that you don't let this, you know, voice be out there. And you say that you stand for certain things. Well, this is, you know, something that falls within what you claim to stand for. So, I mean, the most I've seen is she does let a lot of the no signs. She'll show them, but she won't let people come on. Okay, well, you know, we don't have to accept that. You don't have to treat her as if she's in the camp of the enemy, but it's wrong what she's doing. We don't have to accept it. You know, look, we ourselves have to act, and I'm not saying people aren't, but I'm just saying this is an important principle for us. We have to mean what we say, and we have to act on the basis of what we're saying to other people. We're saying that, you know, this is a deadly serious matter. We're saying that it's intolerable that this regime remain in power. We're saying that, you know, that we can't just go along with a normal routine. Well, then we can't. then we have to go and do things that are way outside the norms of what we're used to doing also. Find creative ways where people are, you know, broadly speaking on the right side of things, but they're doing things wrong. We should call them out, but not treat them like the enemy. We should struggle against them. We should expose it when they do things that are wrong, and not just wrong, but harmful, that hurt what needs to happen, without pushing them into the camp of the enemy. There are a lot of creative things, but, you know, it requires of us that we act in accordance with what we're saying is the case, which it is, in fact, the case. So there are a lot of different stratagems, if you want to use that word. Getting people who do have prominence, you know, pushing on them. Look, I heard a story, and, you know, somebody, you know, I referred during my talk to the article I wrote, you know, a question, a challenge for Paul Krugman and all those concerned about the future of humanity. You know, I heard a story about somebody went to talk to somebody about that article, and they said, and the person they were talking to said, well, what does Paul think of this article? Because they know Paul Krugman. And the answer was, well, we sent it to him, but we haven't heard an answer. That's not good enough. You know, you should say to that person, well, you know, that's what's happened. How about you? Since you know him, how about you send the article to him? How about you tell him this is something important you ought to read? How about you help us, you know, getting to where we can sit down and talk with him? There are a lot of things people can do that don't require them, you know, to from our point of view, to join a revolution tomorrow, you know, or to become full-time activists and refuse fascism tomorrow. A lot of, we should think creatively. How can people contribute in ways that correspond to what they, you know, can be shown would be important for them to do, mm-hmm. without it being a full commitment? Then we can struggle. You need to get fully committed. But you know, in the meantime, let's find ways that people can contribute who would like to contribute, but we don't help them, you know, find the ways to do that. So we need to get better at that also. You know, and so all these different kind of things, the main current running through all this, if you will, is that we really have to be creative because the situation demands it of us. We have to not accept, you know, no, yes, but we have to not accept no for an answer. On a different plane. You know, no idea.
Okay, we'll just shoot for it then. All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, and that was taken from his piece. His speech, the film of his speech, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time, taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before the war.
All right, welcome back. That was Sonny Meadows with Just Like Germany Before the War. All right, and a lot of people, whenever I play that, people write in and say, oh, I got to get that, man. Well, it's Sonny Meadows, Just Like Germany Before the War. And yeah, it's the theme song for today, okay? Because that's where we're at and what we need to be thinking about. Now, I want to say a word about the segment that we're about to hear. I interviewed filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman about an important film screening they're presenting, Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? Two films and two panels. Now, this is happening in Los Angeles, but it's something that should spread everywhere. Anti-fascist art and culture is vital right now for the future of humanity, to inspire and to help people figure out what's happening with the fascist Trump-Pence regime? And, as the name of the screening puts it, what can we do about it? All right, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show two people who I know, and I know what they do, and they do good work, filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman. And both of them have been on the show previously, but they're actually coming today to talk about an event that they are presenting, and it's called Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? That's actually, is that the overall title, Dave?
Yes.
Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? And it's featuring two films and two panels. So, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Perry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
Yeah, I really like the way you're dressed today, man. It's like real... All right, folks, because Perry is over the phone line, so that was a little...
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, let's jump into this. David, let's start with you. Is It Fascism and What Can We Do About It? This series of events, give people an overview of what it's about.
Okay. Several months ago, Perry and I started getting together and trying to work out doing a film festival, an anti-fascist film festival. And this thing has evolved over time to what we're hoping will be a film series that we'll be doing this regularly. And for me, the point here and the question is there's really nothing, I guess, nothing more important right now than this question of, is it fascism? Meaning, of course, the Trump-Pence regime. And what is that an accurate description of what's going on? And in that context, what do people do about it? How do you confront it? And one of the things that's been really interesting over the last year is that the understanding of what happened in Germany and how it happened has become a very big topic, not just in universities, but there have been books published, and much has been revealed, I think, about the lead up to this consolidation of fascism in Germany. And a lot of it, as a whole lot of people have pointed out, is very relevant to today. So I'm a filmmaker and a cinephile, and I believe that film can play a very important role in this debate and discussion. It's not the end-all and be-all of it, but it can spark it can really spark some real discussion and some real understanding. So these two films that we're presenting on Sunday, May 6th, this is films, and then we have panels going along with it. But the films are first and foremost. They're two fantastic films. One from 2002 is Prisoner of Paradise, which Stuart Sender, one of the directors of the film, will be part of the panel afterwards, which is a harrowing story that really is the story of an artist who strove to survive within the confines of Nazi Germany. And it's very relevant to now because so much of us, we're faced with this question of, do we confront what's going on? Do we try to find our way to continue to function? And then what happens? And the story of Prisoner of Paradise is a real lesson in what can happen. The other one is The Mortal Storm, real quickly, which is an MGM narrative film that was made in 1940 that was so provocative that it was banned from Germany. It's with Jimmy Stewart, and it is about the rise of fascism in a small Bavarian town and how that impacts on the people there.
I want to talk to you more about the films themselves because I'm familiar with The Prisoner of Paradise, but I'm not familiar with The Mortal Storm. Perry, I wanted to talk to you about what brought you into this whole operation here.
Well, so I've been working with the group Refuse Fascism since just before the inauguration, and we've in a lot of ways that's clearly my viewpoint that these guys are fascists and that we have to really confront this in a serious way, and that one of the aspects of fascism is that they don't respect the rule of law and they don't play by the rules, basically. So to put all your effort, a lot of people right now are putting their efforts into the midterms and trying to deal with this through the normal channels, which is, I can't argue that it's not something that people should be doing, but we have to confront what this really is. And on the other hand, it's clear that, like, as Dave said, this is coming much more into mainstream discussion this question of fascism, but it's in a lot of people's minds, it's not an answered question. And the thing is, you can't just say, you can't just assert that that's what we're facing and expect everybody to go along with you. So Dave and I were just, talking about this, and the idea behind this was to really kind of create a forum where we could actually discuss this question. A lot of what Refuse Fascism does, you know, to some extent, I feel like the people who get it and join us. The people who don't get it for whatever reasons or have reservations or objections, it's hard to bring them in into the fold. And the thing is, doing something like this, using film, using art, using, you know, creative activity, is a way to really sort of create a forum for dialogue. So this, you know, as we were talking about this and planning it, originally we had hoped to do a whole film festival, and instead we sort of narrowed our focus a little bit to do this one event, and then hopefully that will be the first of a series. And the film festival, actually, I should mention, it came with the initials for the film festival were FFFF, which stood for Fight Fascism Film Festival, or something I can't mention on the air. It had two alternative names. We started by compiling a list of films that we thought were relevant, and we have close to 100 films on that list now. And that, because actually this question, it's a much broader question than just what we're going through right now. It's a whole question about, you know, people, citizens' roles in society and what our relationship with government is, with the kinds of you know, the forms that state rule takes, and when it shades over into something that can be properly called authoritarian or fascist. And, you know, if you start to look at it, you start to realize that it figures largely in genres like science fiction. There's documentaries. There's a lot of narrative films from the Hollywood era, from the contemporary era. I mean, there's a lot of that's come out of Germany, both if you look at the rise of fascism in the 30s and then the aftermath of the Second World War, people dealing with what happened. It's just, it so permeates kind of culture, both high art and popular culture, that this just seems like just a goldmine opportunity to really look at what's happening, to put it in a cultural context and bring people in to talk about it and really raise these questions in a real way and answer people's, you know, concerns about this and sort of figure out where we're going to go. So the first panel that we'll have will be primarily looking sort of back at history and looking at possible parallels and, you know, what's the same, what's different. I mean, one fact about fascism, it never happens the same way twice. So, you know, you have to confront this idea that this can't possibly be fascism because of this or this fact. You know, the state and corporate interests aren't working together in the same way they did in Germany or Italy or Spain. But on the other hand, it wasn't the same. You know, when it happened in Germany, there was no precedent for it in anything happening in exactly that way. So that's not really an objection. So you have to kind of see the context and then really ask this serious question of what, you know, what's the same, what's different. Then the second panel will look at going forward, what can we do and what do we need to do? And, you know, basically look at this question. Can we do this through the electoral process? Are the midterms going to like make a difference? Is Mueller's investigation going to make a difference? Can we even survive till 2020 if nothing else happens? All of those questions need to be raised. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'll just also say one more thing, which is that I feel like that to reach people and to reach people in the numbers that we need to reach them, it's not one slogan's not going to do it. You know, one way of expressing this is not going to reach people. You have to use everything at your disposal, and different tactics are going to reach different people. Some people, some people are going to be there because they love being in the streets and it's a chance to really make a change. Some people, it's because it's just so ridiculous and so absurd that this is happening that they just can't live with themselves and that, you know, until they do something. And then other people, you know, are really, they're going to raise their voices in different ways and they can be reached in different ways.
All right, let's dig into this. Let's dig into this, all right, because yeah. I think it's important to actually dig a little bit deeper into this. And I wanted to ask, Dave, you something here. You know, it's like, One of the things that's going on is when in the past, when Germany, when the fascists in Germany actually consolidated their rule, what happened, you know, the assault on humanity didn't actually unfold overnight or in a vacuum, you know, and with a sudden roundup, you know. It followed a well-calculated and implemented historical rewrite, as people were saying. And it's a slow but steady recast of entire people, stripping them of their history, culture, and collective purpose and decency. And you introduced me to one of the films on that's going to be in this festival, which is The Prisoner of Paradise. And I'd like to talk about that in relation to that what I was just talking about, because I think it's really important in terms of people understanding that these the questions that are going to be posed are very heavy questions that actually have a lot to do with the survival of the entire planet right now.
Yeah, this I think Prisoner of Paradise is a tremendous story to really kind of chew on right now, because it's a story of an artist, Kurt. I forgot his name already. I'm sorry. Kurt Gehren, I'm sorry, who was a brilliant actor in Weimar Germany, Jewish actor, beloved. And his at every step of the way, as the Nazis, you know, consolidated their power, he strove to find a way to keep working. All he wanted to do was keep working. He wanted to act. He wanted to direct. He wanted to be able to practice his art. And that was it. He wanted to practice his art. And I think a lot of people can relate to this. And I'm not going to reveal a lot about the actual story, because it's fascinating. But he ended up making a propaganda film for the Nazis, extolling the Theresienstadt concentration camp, which was the Nazis. One of the things they did, they created this camp that they put artists and intellectuals in, and it was the only camp that they allowed the Red Cross to visit. They presented this camp to the world as being a paradise, and he took on the job of making a propaganda film about this paradise that was Theresienstadt. And this is while millions were being murdered, including most of the people from Theresienstadt in Auschwitz and other places. People look at this history of the Nazis, and it seems like everything was just obvious and everything was straightforward and simple, and it wasn't. And the fact that people like this great artist tried to find ways to accommodate themselves, and the tragic results of that, I have tremendous lessons for us today, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to remind listeners that this is The Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with filmmaker David Zeiger and artist Perry Hoberman about an important anti-fascist film screening that they're organizing called Is It Fascism? And What Can We Do About It? Two films and two panels. Now, Perry, for you, are you familiar with The Mortal Storm in terms of can you tell us something about that?
So The Mortal Storm was this film that was made in 1940, and it's a Hollywood MGM movie with, kind of A-list actors, young Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan. And, I mean, in a lot of, it has some parallels to Prisoner of Paradise in that it really details the kind of, just the sort of process by which you try to accommodate, the rise of fascism, and just, basically different people take different, they have different reactions and more of them collaborate than not. But it's in a sense, kind of the moral lesson is that nobody knows what they're getting into. When they make those compromises, the results are far beyond what they thought they could live with it. And I think that's really, that is the big question, because, in fact, if you think about just any of our lives more generally, we're always making, we don't have absolute freedom. We don't all get to do what we want. We have differences of opinion. We do have to accommodate disagreements and different points of view and so on. And that's just, part of life. But the point is that in certain circumstances, you have to kind of look at what those compromises actually lead to and where they're going. And we do have historical lessons for that. But as Dave said, though, it can be, these things can be quite gradual, and they can sort of slip under the radar. And before, there are times like in Germany in the 30s, where before you know it, it becomes too late, or it becomes much, much more difficult to actually kind of, you know, preserve things. And we're in a, we feel like we're in a situation like that now. We don't, we certainly don't know all the details or all the answers, but it does feel like we're in this, you know, really, really critical period where if things go the way they look like they're going, it could have very, very serious consequences, both for our country, but for the planet as a whole. And art and cinema are, you know, because they sort of express things in a way that sort of stands up, stands the test of time and survives over decades. And, you know, basically they're almost like time capsules or preserving something in amber where you can actually see what people thought at the time, how they responded, you know, how they analyzed what had happened to them and so on. And you get a different perspective than you can possibly get just watching, you know, CNN every day, where it's just like, yeah, one thing leads to another. And it all seems, you know, it all just seems, it's hard to see the overall trajectory of history, and mm-hmm. art and cinema are a way of doing that.
Now, I have one thing. We have probably about, maybe five more minutes, a little bit less, maybe 4 minutes or something like that. So maybe each of you can throw in a 2 minute comment. But reading from the card for the whole event, it says, this year, the Anne Frank Center for Mutual Respect warned of alarming parallels between Donald Trump and Hitler, likening the present day U.S. to the escalating steps of oppression that led to the Holocaust in the 1930s and 1940s. And join us for the for these powerful films, each followed by a panel of historians, educators, artists, and activists as we examine the most pressing question confronting the American people today. Is it fascism, and what do we do about it? Let's talk about that, the most pressing thing confronting American people today. And actually, people of the world, if you want to be frank about it. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Dave, you first.
Well, I mean, for one thing, you have to look at the context of what's happening in this country and its role in the world and its domination of so much of the world and the determination, certainly by particularly by Trump, but by everyone in that position to expand that domination, to expand American, you know, American capitalism. And fascism doesn't happen just in one country. And this is the thing that I think there's a lot of, again, parallels with what was going on in Germany at the time, because what was going on in Germany was going on in Europe as a whole. And we've seen the rise of all of these hyper-nationalist fascist movements. And you could, you know, and I've heard people say, well, but still the United States is the most democratic country than when we live in here, et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is we're living in a world in which what happens in one country is going to have tremendous impact on the other countries. And this country has the power and the ability to wreak tremendous havoc on the world. And this is one of the things that I think people are the most terrified about the Donald Trump and the Trump regime. It really requires us to look at this whole question that's being raised by people such as the Anne Frank Center of, is this actually leading towards, you know, a world conflagration similar to World War II? Is that really something that could possibly happen? And if so, we have to confront it.
Yeah, people have to confront that question. If so, what the hell are you going to do about it to stop it?
Yeah.
Perry, you have in 1 minute. Do you want to make a comment?
Yeah. So I just want to say this is happening. I mean, it's sad, but this is happening at a critical moment for humanity where we're just starting to understand the impacts of climate change in a, you know, it's worse than we thought. And the results of it already, things that scientists didn't think were going to happen for decades are happening now. And the thing is, that's a big part of the Trump regime is to discredit science and to stay on the side of corporations and the oil companies and so on. And that means, you know, so we're in some ways, this is like it's scarier than what was happening in Germany in the 30s, because it really, we're talking about the survival of humanity. And then finally, I just want to say, it's like a year ago, the word fascism was a dirty word. And whenever we brought it up, everyone complained that it was too strong and it was an epithet and all that. In just the last couple of weeks, it's been in the headlines of op-eds by Madeleine Albright and Paul Krugman, among others, in the New York Times, asking this question, is this fascism? And the thing is, when the Times, something like the Times, an institution like that is asking that question, you know that it's a real question, and it's something we really have to take seriously, because they're pretty conservative and pretty centrist, and they're even talking about it now.
Absolutely, and I want to really thank you for bringing that up. And I also want to say, and then we all have facing us is the question of what are we going to do about it? That's the big question. Perry, David, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
All right. And once again, folks,
lot, do not,
sure, Perry. This is the Anti-Fascist Film Festival, two films and two panels. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson and Henry Carson, my assistant producer, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. So we'll talk to you again next week. Troubled time.